I am here with Dr. Monica Arndt, who is from the University of Florida. She is a gerontologist in the sociology department. And if you don't mind, please share a little bit about yourself, your current role, and how you came into gerontology, or how perhaps gerontology or the field of aging found you.
Well, I have to co correct you here. I'm not a gerontologist. I'm a life course
A life
researcher.
course researcher.
And that makes a difference because I do focus on old age, but more as the last chapter of a book. So I really like to look at the whole book. And the question is, how did people end up in old age in the way they are? And the way I got to it was really from my dissertation. I was interested in life satisfaction in old age. And from a sociologist, typically what they look at, are these more objective factors, like socioeconomic status. Of course, this matters. Education, financial situation. Subjective health matters a lot, how people feel about their health. But in the end, social integration, if they're integrated or lonely. But in the end, it cannot really explain a lot of the variance, maybe with the exception of subjective health. But I thought there was something missing. And I was playing around with it, and I was thinking about coping. Autonomy, but autonomy is one of the first things that goes, if you get older and older. And then it kind of occurred to me and was like, oh, it's wisdom. But then I didn't know how would you measure wisdom? How would you approach it? And at this time, I had a data set that I wanted to analyze. It was a longitudinal data set for my dissertation that used data from the parents of the Berkeley Guidance Study kids that were followed up from their birth to really the whole life. But at the birth of these children, the parents were also interviewed. And then these parents were followed up 40 years later. And my advisor, Dr. Glenn Elder, he had this data set. So I wanted to analyze this data set, and I needed to go to the library to find a book that explained how the follow-up data was collected. And so I went to the library and I got the book, and right next to it was this Sternberg book on wisdom. It's nature, development, and something. It just came out, it was 1990. And I'm like, wow, there are actually people who study this. I had no idea. So of course I got the book, and also I saw it as a sign. This is a sign, you should study this. So I got the book and I read it. It was edited. It's an edited book, so different people talking about what wisdom is, how to measure it. It was all over the place. There was no unifying definition of wisdom, but many of these chapters and authors, they referred to this chapter by Clayton and Bearing, 1980. And so I went and got that, and basically what Vivian Clayton, they did a multidimensional scaling analysis of wisdom attributes. And they came up with this three-dimensional wisdom model, that wisdom is a combination or integration of cognitive, reflective, and what they called affective, what I call now compassionate dimensions, because the compassionate dimension, it's not just any affect, any emotion, it's actually compassion. And I thought, ooh, that makes sense. Maybe it is not possible to measure wisdom directly. But it should be possible to measure the cognitive, reflective, and the compassionate dimensions of wisdom. So I looked at my data set, and lo and behold, I had ratings of personality characteristics, the QSORT and Hahn's ego rating scale, and I selected items to measure the cognitive, reflective, and compassionate dimension of wisdom, and it worked. They hang together. And they predicted life satisfaction in old age to a really strong degree. And so this is kind of that set me on this path, on to study wisdom. And then when I came to the University of Florida as a faculty member, my faculty mentor suggested, well, why don't you create a wisdom scale? And so I got a little grant, you know, and, you know, started out, you know, creating the scale. And this is how I ended up with the three-dimensional wisdom scale. And so for me, getting into gerontology was really from this life course longitudinal perspective. And I used to say, I'm really not interested in older people, but I actually am, you know, I really am. I mean, because it's really fascinating to talk to older people about their life, not just where they are right now, but also how did they arrive at the place they are now? And then all of them have a story behind it. So it's not just random who ends up in a good shape or not so good shape. It's actually, there is a history, you know, that explains this. So like a history of taking care of your health, you know, taking care of your physical and your mental health and developing wisdom throughout the lifetime. Wisdom doesn't suddenly pop up in old age. You know, it's a developmental process that starts early in life. And those who end up with wisdom in old age have developed wisdom throughout their life.
And in your years of research and developing your measure, can you speak to the extent of what really, you know, oftentimes people ask the question, what makes a person wise? Have you been able to answer that question?
Yes, so the three-dimensional wisdom model. Uh-huh. Well, the way I define it, you know, is exactly what makes a person wise if they have these three characteristics. You know, if you think about what is wisdom, many people think about first, wise people know something that other people do not know, right? And so this belongs to the cognitive dimension. But what they do know is not just, you know, what's the latest research in quantum physics, right? So this is not the area of wisdom. The area of wisdom is about the interpersonal and intrapersonal aspects of life. Basically, wise people know about themselves. You know, they have engaged in self-reflection. You know, they know who they are, and they also know their weaknesses. But they also know how to interact with other people. So this is the interpersonal aspects of life. And they know the meaning, the deeper meaning of life. Why are we here, right? So they have a sense of meaning and purpose in life. To get to this cognitive deeper understanding of life, deeper meaning of life, to get to this requires a reflective dimension of wisdom. So the reflective dimension of wisdom for me is the process to get to the other two dimensions. So the reflective dimension, the way I define it, is basically looking at things and events or people from different perspectives, but also looking at yourself from a kind of a third person perspective, right? So this is where it requires self-examination, self-insight, and then also being able to understand other people from different perspectives and then learning from that, you know, getting insight from that, learning from experience belongs in that, you know, because everybody has experiences, but not everybody learns from experiences. And to learn from experiences requires to stop, stand still, and reflect on the experience. Okay, what does this mean? Right? What can I learn from this experience? And that gets us then to people who learn from experience, understand life better, understand other people better, understand oneself better, and which goes to the cognitive dimension, but also understand their own faults and weaknesses better. So basically to understand that they, like anybody else, you know, has their faults and weaknesses. And often for not so wise people, it's easy for them to see the faults and weaknesses in other people, but not in themselves, right? And so if wise people can see their own faults and weaknesses and can forgive themselves for it, have self-compassion, then they can extend this compassion to others as well. So it actually, through the reflective dimension, it reduces ego-centeredness, self-centeredness, and makes one more tolerant toward the faults and weaknesses of other people. And that then leads to the compassionate dimension of wisdom. So people who have integrated cognitive, reflective, and compassionate components, this is what I would call a person wise.
And you know, when you think about aging and older adults, when you meet that person after 65, 70 plus years, you talk about the narrative and stories that you've heard and you've studied. Is it possible, do you think, that some people become wise beyond their years, so to speak, that perhaps they actually become wise or find wisdom before their time? Or perhaps maybe the opposite is possible. They never really fully tap into their wisdom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Both is possible. Pascal Leone, Juan Pascal Leone says, you know, how do people get wisdom? And he says there are two pathways. And one is if people encounter what he calls ultimate limit situations. So these are these situations that, you know, if they don't kill you, they make you stronger. I mean, really traumatic events, you know, that can shatter one's worldview and really require a rearranging of priorities. And that can make people wiser, or really, you know, they can also lead to absolute despair and depression. You know, it could be both ways. But people who become wiser as a result of this, you know, learn something from this experience, that can be at any age, at absolute any age. Even so, probably there needs to be a certain amount of intellectual maturity, but I would say, you know, starting with, you know, formal operations or so, I mean, that would be already in place. Maybe not really small children, but definitely adolescents can be wise, particularly if they had to overcome trauma and learn from this experience. Then on the other hand, people who have experiences but never learn from it, you know, because they are so self-centered and they can only see the world through their own filter and do not see the other person's perspective, might never become wise. You know, they say experience is not enough. You have to learn from experience, you know, so it's these opportunities to learn from experiences. So this is one of the things that he says is one pathway. I kind of a little bit disagree with him, because I think any experience can make one wiser. You know, it's the little things. You know, somebody cuts you off in traffic, you know, a famous example. How do you react to it, you know? And our gut reactions are, right? But to say it's okay, right? This person maybe had really to be somewhere, you know, or, you know, they can't help it, you know, and what does it matter, you know, that just to deal with that, you know, makes you already a little bit wiser. If you can not get riled up if somebody cuts you off in traffic, and I know it's hard for me, I'm still working on it. Sometimes I'm better than other times. But then the other path that Pascal Leone mentioned was meditation, actually. You know, so have some kind of praxis, I would say, of reflection. Meditation could be one thing, but it can also be therapy or writing your memoir, you know, some journaling or something. I think anything that helps you to reflect on experience are probably helpful to become wiser.
Yeah, and in your work, I know you've made a connection to the kind of the wisdom and human spirit sort of connection. Can you kind of elaborate a little bit on that? You know, how does it contribute to the human spirit?
How do you find the human spirit?
How do you define it?
How do you define it? You just brought it up.
I think the human spirit for me would be sort of thinking about kind of existential, more transcendent kind of quality, where you move beyond oneself.
Right.
And really thinking about life in a much deeper way that's perhaps beyond this world, even. How is wisdom kind of connected, do you think, to that kind of process? And, you know, some people find it through religiosity,
yeah.
Attending church or prayer. others find it through, as you mentioned, meditation, more of a spiritual reflection?
Yeah, that's a good question, particularly since you bring in the religion, you know, in there. In some ways, I think all religions originally were vehicles to make human beings wiser. I think that was the plan. You know, if you think, you know, Jesus Christ, what does he saying? You know, I mean, you know, he tries to make people wiser. Look at yourself first, you know, before you judge others, you know. I mean, Buddha clearly, you know, trying to teach the meditation to make people wiser, you know, Mohammed, you know, I think all of them, you know, all of the religions, the idea is to make people wiser. The problem is if religion becomes dogmatic and then somebody says, well, all you need to do is just proclaim, you know, this or that or the other, or just do these rites and rituals and you will be fine. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, what kind of person you are. As long as you proclaim this, you know, you will be fine. It doesn't work that way. You know, at least not from where I'm sitting. You know, I think if a religion is there to make a person wiser, to understand the deeper meaning of life, why are we here? What is the deeper meaning? You know, in the end, all of the religion, what they are saying, you know, try to become a little bit nicer, you know, to be less self-centered, to love your neighbor. You know, love God. What does love God mean, right? I mean, love everything. Love your neighbor. Hard enough, right? Who's my neighbor, right? How do I love my neighbor? Well, become less self-centered. As long as a religion does this, then I think it's the same. It's wisdom and religion is exactly the same. If it becomes dogmatic, then no. I think then now they have split paths.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for sharing. Kind of switching gears just a little bit, across the years of research and your expertise on wisdom, have you encountered or have that one discovery or finding, whether it's focused on wisdom or maybe another topic, that's intrigued you the most, something that you've discovered that you think has advanced the field or the knowledge, something do you think, is there that one discovery or finding that you've had in your career that you think is pretty important, pretty valuable?
Well, I tell you what I really, and that might be more personal or rather than, you know, the great discovery for the scientific community. But where I was really surprised about one of this finding is that self-centeredness is really toxic. And the way I found this is I had the good fortune that, George Wayland made available this longitudinal data set for some people. And so I was selected a senior positive psychology fellow and spent some time with George Wayland in Philadelphia one summer for 6 weeks. And as part of this, we were allowed to use this Harvard data set. This is a data set of men that were first surveyed basically examined their personality and everything in the 1940s, really. They came all from the birth years 1919 to 1920-something. So they examined as sophomores if they showed potential for greatness. I think this is how they were selected, you know. And they wanted to, the purpose of the study was to see, you know, how people, future leaders, you know, how they develop. But then when George Wayland took over the study, it became just a really longitudinal study. And these men have been followed until their death, really. And so every 2 years, I think starting in the 40s, at the beginning they were studied intensively, and then they were sent, every 2 years they were sent a questionnaire, and every 10 years, I think, somebody came and did qualitative interviews with them. And they had personality questionnaires at the age of 50, and then at the age of 80. And I used my three-dimensional wisdom model to select the items, you know, for the three dimensions of wisdom. And I And I looked at men that were high on these three dimensions at 50 and at 80, and then low on these dimensions at 50 and at 80. So really do an extreme case analysis comparison. And not surprisingly, you know, the exemplar that was really high, you know, on both, I mean, he just had a charmed life. He was always happy. You know, he was full of optimism. He founded several businesses. He taught business students, but he didn't have a perfect, easy life. His father was an alcoholic. He got him into AA, helped him to come out of this. His first wife divorced him, and he said, I'm happy. He found the perfect mate. She found the perfect mate. Was one of my best friends. I'm happy for them. You know, so he was, and then he found another wife, the second wife, and they were perfect together, and they lived, you know, until his death. So it doesn't mean that he had, in terms of a charmed life, that there was no obstacles there. It is, was just for him, whatever obstacle he encountered, he was able to overcome it. And when he was asked in old age, you know, in terms of how his psychological mood was, he was like, I'm happy. My whole life was great. My whole life was great. Even so, the father was an alcoholic. The first wife divorced him, you know. And so, no, my first life, my life, I was blessed. I was blessed because of this And his secret was that he cared about others. He really cared about others and tried to give to the next generation. He was teaching, he was advising, he was mentoring. He was involved in charities, you know, foundations, all kind of things. He had lots of energy because of that. Now compare this to this other man who was low on the wisdom scale. He came to Harvard as a scholarship student. That meant that his parents were not rich, but he was smart enough to make it to Harvard. But because he came as a scholarship student, he had a low self-esteem. And he always felt that he wasn't good enough like these other folks. He had a successful career as an architect. He married a woman who was above his social standing. She was rich. He admired his mother-in-law, who was, I think, one of the few people who was a career woman. But it was never enough. Whatever he had, it was never enough. And yes, there was a problem with his wife, and his wife was ill and eventually died. But he used people. Then he dated other women, but didn't want to get tied down until later in life, I think with 60, he married again to a widow that, again, was rich and was high in social standing. And it still wasn't enough. It still wasn't enough. He wanted even more social standing, more money. It was just never enough. And because of that, he was miserable. His whole life was miserable. And that showed me that, you know, being selfish, you know, thinking, yeah, people are selfish. Of course, everybody is selfish. You know, so what? You know, no, it has real consequences. Being selfish has real consequences. And for this man, it ruined his whole life. Even so, objectively, people would say, look, you know, I mean, he was Harvard educated, he had a good career, had a good job, he didn't like his job, even so he had a good job, you know, he chose it, you know, he had a rich wife, a high in social standing, you know, yes, there was some misfortune, but still, you know, objectively, it wasn't bad, it wasn't a bad life, and he was miserable his whole life. So, being selfish has real costs. And that's what I learned, you know, be careful, you know, don't be selfish because it really has real costs. It ruins you. Being selfish ruins you. Being caring and giving rewards you. And that these two men are really exemplars of that.
Yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, there's some consequence to finding wisdom or just looking back when you're older and saying, this is what mattered most.
Right, absolutely.
Now, a final question just to kind of wrap things up. This course is really focused on finding out a little bit and understanding the concept of successful aging. This is a concept, it's been around for a while and it's highly debated. What's your perspective surrounding that kind of Roh and Khan framework of successful aging? In other words, how do you define successful aging?
Right, so Roh and Khan define successful aging basically as avoiding disease, right? Avoiding disease, staying mentally active, cognitively active, also staying socially active, being involved in society in some ways, And if you look at this, no disease, staying involved in society, being cognitively, mentally intact, well, that's really what happens in midlife. So what they are saying is avoid aging. As long as you avoid aging, you will be fine. The problem with this definition of successful aging is that what happens to people who do get sick, who do get disabled, A cognitive decline, it will be happening, I mean, we can't, yes, there is something we can do, but not completely. I mean, this is just biology. Eventually, even if you can avoid it, okay, before maybe cognitive decline, physical decline started to in the 50s, 60s, maybe you eat right, you exercise, you exercise your gray cells, everything, you do everything right. You can push it to 70, 80. You can push it to 80. But if you look at the statistics, in the 80s, things start going downhill for at least a third of the population, if they're not already dead, I mean. So then it really starts. All right, maybe with better nutrition and everything, education, we can push it another 10 years, maybe 90. Well, what about then, right? I mean, the idea what Roh and Khan have is kind of you're staying healthy like in midlife and then you just drop dead. For most people, this is not the case. For most people, there is a period of decline that they experience, and sometimes we think of people, oh, they just dropped dead, these poor people. Well, maybe they weren't poor because up to this point, they were functioning quite well, right? But and now what we are able to do is to keep people alive with chronic illness, with disability, with cognitive decline. But they still experience all this decline. So what does this mean? Now they are unsuccessful ages? We should give up on them? So this is why I don't like successful aging, the term successful aging. I like aging well. Now it might be semantics, but I think, in terms of aging well, what does aging well mean? Aging well means to experience satisfaction with life, subjective well-being, happiness, contentment, maybe not fleeting happiness, but contentment, even in old age, even if there is cognitive, physical decline and a shrinking of the social radius. And what my research has shown that those who are high on wisdom, that they actually, for them, they can keep high in subjective well-being, even if they encounter physical decline. And so one of the study that we did was we compared older people who lived in nursing homes or were diagnosed with a terminal illness, were on hospice. Hospice means that you're diagnosed with a terminal illness and you have a life expectancy of 6 months or less. And then compared them to people, older adults who lived in the community. So relatively healthy, they were healthy enough to live in the community. And if you look at these two groups in terms of subjective well-being, not surprising, that the ones who lived in the community had a higher subjective well-being, not surprising. But there was an interaction effect with wisdom, meaning that those who were in the nursing home or belonged to the group of nursing home hospice patients who had were high on wisdom, there was no difference in their subjective well-being between those in the community and then if they belonged to the end-of-life group. I call this the end-of-life group. So in this case, wisdom really helped them to maintain their subjective well-being. Even so, the objective circumstances, their objective circumstances were absolutely not ideal. And so this is why I think wisdom is really, really useful in old age, to keep subjective well-being, contentment, even if the circumstances are not ideal. Basically, Gordon Kahn says, hey, if everything is great, right, you will feel great. Yes, yes, I believe that. Absolutely true. But the problem is you have no control over this. You don't have control when disability hits or when a terminal illness hits or if it's just a chronic illness hits that affects you negatively in old age. And it's very likely that this will happen. And then what, right? Are you now getting, you become an unsuccessful ager and just give over to despair? Or is there a way to basically salvage subjective well-being even under these circumstances? And I would say wisdom helps with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great way to put that concept, the experience and the research that you saw, the comparison, that makes great sense. You know, people that have some wisdom, have some experience, we can't see, you know, what they think. We may objectively say, oh, that person's not doing well. and I think we never look into the experience or the experiences that persons have had. And I think you're spot on that. I appreciate your insight. Well, that concludes our interview. And I want to thank you very much for taking the time for doing and sharing your insights.
Thank you. Thank you for talking to me.